Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, we examine the latest in state and local politics and remember former governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham. Later in the program, a dance performance inspired by the story of Amelia Island's historic Black resort, American Beach. But first, the death of a centrist and beloved statesman casts into stark relief the politics of the day. What lessons can we still learn from former Governor Bob Graham? To discuss that, we're joined by his former co-author, speechwriter, and press secretary, Jacksonville attorney Chris Hand. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Ann.
So, Chris, first of all, our condolences. I know that you worked with Bob Graham for a long time. How did you meet him, and what was he like?
Well, you know, I feel like I met him in the way that many Floridians did, which is I sort of grew up under the leadership of Bob Graham. You know, when I was, he was elected governor when I was 5 or 6 years old, and sort of spent most of my upbringing with Bob Graham as either the governor or the U.S. senator from Florida. I think when I was in eighth grade is when he was elected to the Senate. And as someone who was interested in government and politics from an early age, he was the elected official that I most looked up to and that I most admired. So, you know, when I was in college and decided that what I wanted to do after college was spend some time working on Capitol Hill, there was no question about where I wanted to be, and that was working for U.S. Senator Bob Graham. So after a brief stint working for another senator, I, after somewhat persistently stopping by his office all the time to see if there were vacancies, was, you know, fortunate enough to have one of the luckiest breaks of my life, and that was the opportunity to join his staff. So I met him personally for the first time in February of 1996, but felt like I had known him for a long time before that because of his ability to relate to Floridians and establish relationships with Floridians, you know, in his roles as governor and senator.
And that's a feeling and emotion he left a lot of people with. As you said, you've been attending a lot of events around, you know, commemorating him, including his lying in state in Tallahassee. A lot of people felt like they had a personal connection.
Well, and that was very much because of how he approached his role as a public servant. There was very little, you know, in terms of his job that he loved more than connecting with Floridians, learning from Floridians, working with them in their jobs. As you know, he did 408 workdays alongside Floridians at different jobs in the state throughout his career. And that was really at the core of who he was as a public official, staying connected to the constituents he represented, taking their ideas and trying to implement them in either Tallahassee or Washington, and just sort of truly becoming friends with them. And I cannot count the number of times that Senator Graham and I would be in a restaurant or some other public place and someone would recognize him, come up, tell their story, and he would sit and listen and ask questions, ultimately take down their contact information, and they would invariably get a letter or some other kind of communication from him. He always valued those learning opportunities and those opportunities to build personal relationships and friendships with Floridians. It's not easy to do in a state that is now 20 million people, but Bob Graham was very committed to those sorts of working and personal relationships.
You know, his death was covered by pretty much every national outlet, of course. One obituary I read, I think it was the Washington Post, he was described as, quote, a consensus-building governor who became one of the most popular politicians in the state's history. And I think that that phrase alone is an indicator of just kind of how far we've come, because really, you know, viewing our politicians today as statesmen is something that it's rare. Graham had an 83% approval rating when he left office.
Well, and I think that reflects a lot of aspects of kind of, again, how he approached his job as governing. He was never partisan. I mean, one of the first things he told me the first week I was working in his office in Washington was, the way we do things here is we look for opportunities to work across party lines and work with Republicans because we want to be consensus building here. We might be Democrats, but at the end of the day, we're representing the entire population here in Florida. And so we want to make sure that we work with anybody who's going to help us do that. And he was truly committed to that. He had a, during the time I worked for him in the United States Senate, had a very close working relationship and personal friendship with Connie Mack, his Republican colleague from Florida. They were truly friends and worked together very effectively on a number of issues. Just one example, during that period of time, Bill Clinton was president. There was, for parts of that or most of that, a Republican majority in the House and Senate. one of the issues, an issue we still see today, was the issue of getting judges approved or getting new judgeships approved by the United States Senate and the House so Florida could meet its ever-growing population. Many states struggle with that. One that didn't was Florida, because Bob Graham and Connie Mack had such a close relationship. They involved each other in their judicial selection processes and in the process of getting these nominees. Because of that collaboration, Florida was in a much better place. That's how he approached his job at every rung of public service, whether it was in the legislature or governor or U.S. Senate, wanting to build consensus, work across party lines, and be forward-thinking. And I think all of that helped him be very effective and, you know, develop that level of support from Floridians.
And the praise that he received since his death from Republicans, I thought it was very interesting. Former Mayor John Payton, a Republican, called him, quote, genuine, authentic, practical, transparent, ethical, and the standard bearer for what a statesman could and should be. Really remarkable praise in what is a hyper-partisan era. But it's worth remembering, you know, John Payton's father sold to the state the Guana property that is, you know, that giant preserve in Northeast St. John's County. That was because of Bob Graham.
Well, it's one of the many monuments to Bob Graham that exist here in Northeast Florida, Ann, and you're absolutely right. Almost, you know, exactly 40 years ago in, you know, this period in the 1980s, the state of Florida, when Senator Graham was governor at that point, and the Gate Corporation, led by Herb Payton, reached an agreement to preserve Guana Preserve in sort of the Ponte Vedra, St. John's County area. For anyone who hasn't spent time at Guana, I highly encourage it. I like to hike there and think of Senator Graham every time I do. That was a remarkable example of public-private cooperation on environmental preservation, but it's just one of several. For example, if you go into the northern part of our Northeast Florida region, Big Talbot Island State Park, that also exists because when Senator Graham was Governor Graham, he worked to preserve that for future generations. So those are just a couple of the many monuments here in Northeast Florida to Senator Graham's work, his dedication, and his effectiveness.
Well, I want to move on now to a topic that seems bound to break any day now. The city and the Jaguars have long been saying May was the month for an agreement to renovate the stadium, that it would come before the Jacksonville City Council in May. So May's here. What happens now, Chris?
Well, what we're told is going to happen is that at some point these agreements are going to be brought before the city council. The city's lead negotiator, Mike Weinstein, has said that it will not be an agreement. It will be more like seven or eight agreements, hundreds of pages for this deal, which could be somewhere in total, including the city's contribution, in the range of $1.5 billion or so. So the process will be like there have been for other agreements the city has had with the Jaguars. You know, the mayor's office will likely bring that to the city council, and then the council will have a period of review. We've also heard from Council President Ron Salem that there will be some opportunity for public input into that process as well. But I anticipate this takes at least 60 days for this to go through the city council, and we'll see what the final result is there.
Now, you've been through a negotiation process when you were chief of staff in the city with the Jaguars, negotiating, you know, different kinds of deals, including scoreboards and the pool. And why does it make sense to you that it would be seven agreements? Why might there be so many different agreements?
Because it could cover a lot of different aspects. One is going to be a funding agreement, obviously, in terms of how does the city fund. It's, you know, it's not clear, and I guess whenever the deal is announced, we'll find this out. The city's share is probably going to be somewhere between $750 million and $1 billion. So one agreement is probably a funding agreement. There's probably another agreement that relates to the naming and signage on the new stadium. Probably another one still that could be the lease. You know, obviously, and a crucial part of this deal is, will the Jaguars lease be extended by the life of the, you know, the funding of the new stadium another 30, 35 years? So there are a lot of different moving parts to this. But at the end of the day, I think taxpayers are primarily interested in a variety of questions. One being, what's the cost going to be? And what are the benefits of that investment? And what are the potential opportunity costs, the trade-offs of those investments? How might this affect the city's ability to fund other operational and capital priorities going forward?
It's a big question. If you're just joining us, we're catching up on what's happening in state and local politics, as we do each month with Jacksonville attorney and local government expert Chris Hand. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. or you can reach out on social media. So as you noted, City Council President Ron Salem said there might be 2 weeks of meetings, public meetings on this issue. Is that enough time for the public to weigh in on $1 billion plus possibly city investment? And would their comments in such a brief period actually make any difference?
It feels like a very succinct period of time for, you know, public comment on a deal that could have taxpayer impacts of between $750 and $1 billion. This is one of the most significant infrastructure investments the city of Jacksonville will have ever made. Remember, we're talking about potentially $1 billion with a B. That is inevitably going to have operational and capital budget impacts over time that could impact other initiatives and priorities the city funds. So 2 weeks of meetings feels like that might be, like I said, a little overly succinct when, given the scale of this investment, this is probably an opportunity to maybe have as many as 14 meetings, one in each council district, where the city says, look, here's exactly what the deal's going to be. Here's what we see as the benefits of it. Here are what some of the trade-offs might be. Having a very candid conversation with citizens about this is what the kind of impact's going to be over time, and giving citizens an opportunity to weigh in. I think that's always a good idea, not only because citizens are at the top of the organizational chart at the city of Jacksonville, but they are much more likely to buy in or ultimately invest in this deal if they've had an opportunity to hear about it and provide feedback to it.
I heard you mention that earlier when we were talking before the program about this, the citizens being at the top of the organizational chart. And I'm not sure people understand that. I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, at the end of the day, we are in a democratic small d government here where, the consolidation was founded on citizen votes. It was created by the citizenry of Jacksonville. So at the end of the day, who is supposed to be at the top of the organizational chart is the nearly 1 million people living in the consolidated city of Jacksonville. Below them is all the elected officials. You know, I think about this a lot. Senator Graham always talked about how the most important role in democracy was that of citizen. He and I actually wrote a couple of books on that subject about the importance of citizen engagement. So at the top of any governmental organizational chart is the citizens who live in a particular community and elect the officials to govern.
We are expecting that $1 billion possible jail is also in the pipeline. It is, and I know, you know, we don't know the funding source for whatever this proposal will be when it hits the public eye, but does the city even have anywhere near enough resources to finance two essential, like, kind of $1 billion projects simultaneously, given all of the other needs, all of the other infrastructure demands that the city has?
That's an excellent question that the city is going to need to answer over the course of this process, because obviously the Jaguars agreement, whatever that ultimately looks like, is going to have to be weighed against some of those other priorities. You mentioned the idea of building a new Duval County jail. Another one that's crucially important is the long delayed, unfulfilled promises of consolidation, which means that in many neighborhoods across the community, there's very few neighborhoods in the consolidated city of Jacksonville that aren't touched by this in some way. There are decades old, 55 plus year infrastructure needs that have still not been met, whether that's converting from septic tanks to central sewer, whether that's paving or illuminating streets, whether that's building sidewalks, whether that's making sure neighborhoods have potable drinking water. And that's just a few examples. We have pressing infrastructure needs around this community. So all of that has to be weighed in concert with the stadium and the jail. And I think even more important, why the city have a robust schedule of community conversation so people can hear how this fits into the overall kind of infrastructure needs of the city.
Well, we're sure to revisit this issue when and expected to be soon. We'll hear some announcement about this. I want to move on to the topic of ballot initiatives that are going to be coming before voters in November. There are six currently teed up. There may be more, and we can talk about that in a minute. But some of these are put on the ballot by voters, and some are put on by lawmakers. Is there any traditionally or fundamentally any kind of difference about the kinds of amendments that each of those groups tends to put on the ballot?
Well, I think there's a big difference in the process to get those amendments to the ballot. Obviously, the legislature can do that with supermajorities in both houses. So that happens, you know, it's a relatively straightforward process. The process of getting a citizen initiative on the ballot is much more difficult because it obviously involves collecting a certain number of petition signatures, which is a very expensive process. And in recent years, there have been some changes in the way those are regulated that I think have made it even more challenging for some of those groups who want to put issues on the ballot. Has to go through a Supreme Court review to make sure that they believe the ballot initiative meets what's called the single subject rule and doesn't violate other constitutional norms. So it's a very onerous process. And by the way, when you get to the end of that and you actually do get your proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot, it's not just a simple majority to pass it. It's 60% plus one of that. So the two methods, one is much more straightforward. The other one is more complicated. But at the end of the day, they all present initiatives or amendments for voters to consider. And as you say, we, as of right now, we have six on the November ballot.
And one of the big ones is the abortion amendment four. It would enshrine the right to abortion in the state's constitution up to the point of viability at 24 weeks. That's going to be driving a lot of the discussion around Florida politics for the next several months.
Well, with everything on the ballot, the presidential contest, a U.S. Senate contest, I think it's increasingly seems likely that the most intensely contested issue on the ballot is going to be the reproductive choice or the abortion amendment. Obviously, on May 1st, just in the last week, Florida law changed, and so abortion is now banned after 6 weeks of pregnancy, except for a few exceptions. The amendment would shift this back to what was largely in place before the Supreme Court passed the Dobbs decision. It would establish a timing standard of viability that abortions prior to viability were legal, and then after, legal necessary to protect the health of the patient involved as well. So that's going to be on the ballot. There's going to be intense activity around that. You know, I think there's a perception that, you know, Republican candidates have a bit of an advantage in some of the, like I said, the presidential contest and the U.S. Senate contest. But I think so. I think it's this particular amendment that's going to attract tons of attention, resources, people coming to the state to campaign will be for that reproductive choice amendment.
And so there is discussion of a possible special session Memorial Day weekend around that time for the legislature to go back and reconvene. One of the reasons that they're thinking about or talking about is kind of immigration based to pass a law similar to what Texas has, allowing local officials to arrest people who are in the country illegally. But behind that, there's this other discussion that's happening about a possible additional abortion amendment that could be introduced by lawmakers. What can you tell us about what that might look like and why that might be being discussed?
The speculation has been the legislature could come back into special session, which can happen in one of two ways. Either the governor can order, actually one of several ways, but the two most used for the most part, the governor can call them back into special session, and the two presiding officers, the Senate president and the House speaker, can jointly agree to call them back into session. There's been some speculation that they would bring them back to put another abortion amendment on the ballot, one that might say, rather than establish it a viability, have a certain number of weeks, or, you know, and you know, there are folks who are concerned that that might be designed to sort of cloud the issue before voters. In the last 24 hours, the chances of a special session seem to have diminished. The governor was asked yesterday whether he plans to bring back a special session. He essentially said no. He's like, you know, look, I think he'd like to see the legislature do more on immigration, but said, you know, right now we're sort of focused on the budget. So that seemed to diminish some of the likelihood of a special session. Apparently, the state Senate president has told reporters when asked that that's not really in her plans as well. So we'll have to see. You know, the talk was that might occur around Memorial Day. But again, in the last 24 hours, it seems like some of the momentum behind that idea has dissipated and it may not happen.
Well, that's interesting. So another amendment that is on the that will go before voters is one that was brought by lawmakers. It would change the way that campaigns are financed in the state when it comes to the governor races and the state cabinet candidates. Can you tell us what is motivating this change and what it would do?
Sure. So in 1998, voters passed a constitutional amendment that provides for public financing of the governor's race and the other cabinet races. So attorney general, chief financial officer, commissioner of agriculture and consumer services, and essentially provides matching funds from the state for candidates for those offices who qualify for the matching program, but subject to a cap on the amount that their campaign can spend. And the idea of that amendment was to try and, as much as possible, diminish the influence of money in the process, try to limit the amount that these candidates were spending. There have been folks for years who've been opposed to any public financing of campaigns who have attempted to reverse this provision. It was an attempt in 2010 that was not successful. So again, part of this, part of the motivation behind this amendment is a desire to just get the state out of the business altogether of funding these kind of matching funds. There are others who have said, no, this is probably actually controlled some of the money that's in elections. We'll have to see in November whether 60% plus one of voters agree with this amendment.
The idea of observing the cap was sort of, as I recall, first thrown out under Governor Rick Scott, who had sort of so much money that he was able to bankroll his own campaign and wasn't willing, didn't need the match and also didn't want to be constrained by that cap that the match requires.
Yeah, the cap is not on, for First Amendment and other reasons, anyone's self-funding of their campaign. It also does not affect some of the outside committees, whether they're PCs or others, that now where a lot of campaign spending occurs. So, again, this was an effort back in 1998 to change that. We're now at this point, almost 26 years after that. And so we'll have to see whether voters take a different position than they did when this was on the ballot then.
I just want to read an email that we got from Javon. It says the city and residents would want a greater return on investment from spending $1 billion on its own facilities, parks, and riverfront. I'm a day one Jaguars fan, but let the billionaires boys club pay for their own toys. Not an uncommon sentiment, I would say, in the city of Jacksonville. We know that polling has kind of upheld that. Another issue that is going to be before voters has to do with fishing and hunting. And this one is interesting. It would enshrine a right to fish and hunt in the Constitution. It is put on the ballot by lawmakers, but backed by a lot of outdoors groups. One of the things that it says is not only would the right to fish and hunt be preserved in the Constitution, but it would be preserved forever as a right and preferred means of responsibly managing wildlife. Is the preferred means language problematic at all?
I think that has been controversial among some preservation groups. And just to be very clear, the right to hunt and fish is already enshrined in Florida law. It's from a statutory standpoint. This would take it to a higher level of enshrinement and put it in the state constitution. But I think to the extent, and I don't anticipate widespread opposition to this amendment as we sit here today, but I think to the extent that there's been any concern, it has touched on that language, and some preservation groups have wondered, is that going to, preservation lands out there, is that going to impact kind of other environmental or preservation goals on that land? So we'll see if that blossoms into full-scale opposition to this amendment. It has not occurred just yet, but we still have a number of months before the November elections.
So there are also ballot amendments that will be making school board elections, would make school board elections partisan. It would provide for a larger property tax break for people with homestead exemptions. It would make marijuana legal from a recreational standpoint. And those are all things that we'll probably be discussing in the months ahead. But I want to at least briefly touch on the school board search for a superintendent. So yesterday, the Duval County School Board narrowed down to two. They're finalists in their superintendent search. This is their second attempt to search. The first time they didn't get enough qualified applicants. How do you feel about the current pool of applicants and the process in terms of finding somebody who is up to the task?
Well, as we know, this is take two of this process. During the academic year, the Duval County School Board did an initial search, which I think only attracted five or six candidates total. So they decided to kind of shelve that search and start anew. I have one that this time has been led by the Florida School Boards Association that produced, somewhere in the range of 20 candidates. They narrowed it down to five semifinalists, have now narrowed it down to two finalists, one who was most recently the superintendent of the Lee County Schools in Southwest Florida, and another who is the chief of staff at the Loudoun County Schools in the Washington, D.C. suburb. So, again, this is another opportunity for citizen engagement. I believe this coming Monday, the 13th, and that evening at Everbank Field, the Duval County Schools are hosting a community forum with the two finalists and the candidates. That is an excellent opportunity for citizens to show up, attempt to ask questions, try to find out where these two potential superintendents stand on the many crucial issues that are going to be facing the Duval County Public Schools in the years to come.
And so many issues. So that public meet and greet opportunity is, as you said, Monday, May 13th. It's from 6 to 8 at Everbank Stadium. I just want to ask briefly, the one of those two candidates has a recommendation from the head of the schools in Florida, Manny Diaz. Does that tip the scales in his favor?
That'll be very interesting to see how, you know, those kind of factors. Obviously, this has been a sort of unprecedented time in public education, particularly with the relationship between the State Department of Education and a variety of individual school districts around the state. It'll be interesting to see how those sorts of factors kind of play into this. I think important to remember, though, that this is really, at the end of the day, basic math. There are 7 school board members. In order to be selected as a school superintendent, they need the support of 4 of those school board members. It's always preferable if you can have consensus, if you can have 6 or 7 of the school board vote on that. But, you know, there's a lot of 4-3 votes in this day and age in the school board. So it's whichever candidate can attract 4 votes who will be the next Duval County school superintendent.
Well, Chris Hand, thank you so much for coming on the program. We love seeing you every month.
Great to see you, Ann. Look forward to seeing you next month.
All right. Up next, classical ballet meets traditional African dance in a performance that commemorates the Harlem Renaissance. Welcome back. A festival rooted in Amelia Island's cultural landscape showcases classical and contemporary movement while serving as a retreat for dancers. I'm joined now by Susie Dodge, Executive Director of the Amelia Island Dance Festival. Hi, Susie.
Hi. It's my great to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. So how did you personally come to dance?
So I'm originally from Jacksonville. I graduated from Douglas Anderson. I went on to college and found my way to New York. And I had a career as a modern contemporary dancer with Paul Taylor. And then had my own dance company for about 7 years, Dodge Dance Company in New York.
And what is it about dance that appeals to you and the people that you work with?
It's, you know, the connection to the body and expression through the body without words that, you know, it's kind of a sense that we all started dancing, you know, movement as our first language. And I think it's a great outlet for people to find their way to express themselves.
So the Amelia Island Dance Festival, it's been around for a number of years now. Talk a little bit about how it came into being and how long it's been around.
Yes. Yeah, so it was in the passing of Paul Taylor, I was in a room sort of with a lot of different people in the dance world in New York, and they kind of inspired us all to go out and to keep the mission on with dance as an art. And so when I came back to the island, I noticed there was a lot of festivals of music. And I thought, there's a lot of amazing dance in Florida, Northeast Florida. And I wanted to find a way to collectively bring it together. And so 2019, we did our first one and it sold out. And there was an audience for it. And this is our 6th season. And we just keep growing every year. We're bringing artists from Miami and New York and LA, as well as highlighting our local Northeast Florida dance companies.
I think some people are sometimes surprised how many cultural opportunities there are in Amelia Island.
It's pretty amazing. There's music and lots of different types of music, book festivals, there's jazz festival, and that's why I thought the dance festival would be just a great experience on the island.
So what is special about the festival and the people who participate?
You know, as we started to grow and bringing artists down, we started to notice that these artists loved coming to the island and the connection to the island. And it started to, you know, be this idea of a retreat. that artists come and create and connect to the island and the beautiful landscape and the area around. And, you know, it's more than just sitting down and watching dance, that it's that people perform, but they're also going to teach a workshop and sharing and building that community of how together we dance and we share the stage together.
And so the dancers are coming, they view this as kind of a retreat, not just a performance.
Yes. So they really get excited about coming because they can go to the beach and get inspired by their next work. They can use the landscape and the energy and the culture and the history of the island. There's so much of it.
So this weekend, you've got a couple of performances with the Atlanta Dance Connection. Describe their style.
They're amazing. They came out of nowhere last year. They submitted a piece, and then they were a fan favorite in the festival. They blend ballet with contemporary modern with an African dance feel to it. Their athleticism is amazing. Their spirit is wonderful. And, you know, I thought this would be a great special presentation to bring to the island. And we have a lot of great activities connected to that. We have a free workshop and a lecture demonstration that we're going to do on Saturday.
And while they're here, they're going to be brainstorming about a project that would focus on American Beach, which is a historic Black beach that was created during segregation.
Yeah, so the idea of the festival of connecting people on the island with these artists, we are doing that this weekend. The artists are actually going to take a tour on Coast One Tours about the island and about American Beach. And then they're going to meet friends of American Beach and have a luncheon and making those connections to see what could be inspired about creating an original piece.
So where can people find information about the Amelia Island Festival, the dance festival?
So it's ameliaislanddancefestival.org. All the information is on our website and social medias of Facebook and Instagram. And you can get tickets and learn about the workshop, and you can email us as well.
And the performances are May 10th and 11th at the Amelia Island Community Center.
Community Center, yes.
All right. Susie Dodge, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Up next, our own Matt Shaw of WJCT's Jacksonville Music Experience sits down with indie singer-songwriter Kurt Vile ahead of his Thursday night concert here in Jacksonville.
Kurt Vile has always displayed a kind of sly self-awareness. The singer-songwriter and guitarist named his debut solo album Constant Hitmaker. That was 2008, and whether Vile was years ahead of the TikTok manifestation trend, or just throwing out an audaciously silly title for a debut, he has, over the course of a dozen or so albums, emerged as one of the more critically praised and consistent songwriters of the last two decades. Vile's catalog is diverse, but his sound is distinctive, a blend of psychedelia, folk, country, and a range of other influences, with woozy guitar, tons of reverb, a laid-back vocal delivery, and arch, jesting, sometimes hilarious turns of phrase, all of which is on display on Vile's most popular tune, 2015's Pretty Pimpin'. I woke up this morning, didn't recognize the man in the mirror. Then I laughed and I said, oh silly me, that's just me tonight. Vile's latest offering is the 2023 EP Back to Moon Beach. The album's lead single, Another Good Year for the Roses, draws its name from A Good Year for the Roses, a song written by Jerry Chestnut and made popular by the famously tortured country singer George Jones. Co-produced by Welsh avant-pop artist Kate LeBon, The bones of the track came together during a recording session in Northern California with an all-star cast of indie musicians. Vile plays Intuition Aleworks on Thursday, May 9th with his band The Violators. For this edition of Jamie's Liner Notes, I talked to Vile about the writing of the song and how George Jones, Keeping Pianos Everywhere, and his group of collaborators made for another good year for the Roses. Kurt Vile, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, what's up? No problem.
Another Good Year for the Roses was the first single released from your latest EP, and I wanted to start with the title of that song. There's a famous George Jones song, A Good Year for the Roses, which Elvis Costello also had a hit with, and I don't want to assume, but it seems like you referenced Jones in the first verse. You say the greatest country song sung by a man possessed by the devil like myself. Can you talk about how you encountered that phrase, A Good Year for the Roses?
I think my drummer Kyle mentioned, like, I was getting into George Jones in general. I was reading his book, I Live to Tell It All, while I was on tour. And I was told that the George Jones book is, like, more crazy, you know, than any rock and roll book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George Jones is basically the gateway drug into all the country. You know, realizing country music is the gateway to everything, really. You know, I grew up on basic country music through my dad, and it was always in my blood, Hank Williams or Johnny Cash or whatever, you know, and old-time music, bluegrass music through my dad. But once I read that George Jones book, I Live to Tell It All, propaganda and all, it was like, it was all over. It made a lot of rock and rollers look like posers, you know, more or less. Like, these country guys could usually play or sing circles around people, and they were 20 times more crazy, you know. And then my drummer Kyle said, oh, I like the song Good Year for the Roses. When I first heard the George Jones version, I was like, wow, this is the greatest country song of all time. It's been a good year for the roses. Many blooms still linger there. The lawn could stand in another mowing. And I was sitting around at home a lot writing songs on piano, simple arpeggiated songs on piano, and those words just came out because that was my recent obsession, was George Jones. They said it's been a good year for the roses already, so these days I keep it steady on the regular already. By the way, everybody knows that was the greatest country song sung by a man possessed like the devil like myself, now sing with the man.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is an interesting turn of phrase, I think, like, you know, a good year for the roses. I kind of figured, you know, it was like a colloquial thing or like from some part of America, like a phrase that they use. But, you know, I read more about it and, you know, it was just something that was said, you know, to the songwriter. And you mentioned that was sort of the gateway into the song for you. But have you always been interested in language in that way and sort of turning a phrase or using a phrase to then build like more lyrics upon?
I think really I stumble upon it and I get obsessed and influenced by things, and I'm always waiting for my next obsession, and then it's just infectious. And that was my favorite song, you know, and I just wanted to, you know, it just inspires me, and then it gets channeled through me or whatever, you know. And I feel like maybe when I was younger, my influences, I wore them on my sleeve more or something, where I like sang exactly like Lou Reed or something like that. And then it's like when I was younger, I'd be afraid to steal something or realize I stole it from somewhere or think you can't do that. But really, there's nothing exactly new, and you just put your twist on it. Same with writers. And I think about somebody like Bob Dylan or Patti Smith. They're often referencing other writers. I think about that stuff more now than I did then. He said it's been a good year for the roses already. Some others said rock steady, but I'm not trying to hear that these days. These days,
I know at least parts or much of the new EP, including that song, you know, got its start, right? You were recording up in Stinson Beach with a pretty cool cast of characters.
I mean, there was inspiration from the people I was with. I was excited to work with Kate LeBond and Stella Mazgawa, the drummer I had played with for a long time, but also Chris Cohen, slightly lesser known, but very respected songwriter, multi-instrumentalist. He was in the band Deerhoof, but he has his own three solo records that are perfect, and another one on the way, and I was really inspired by it. I was like, how's this new music, or modern music? I just couldn't believe this modern music existed with this guy who produces himself. And my late bandmate, Rob Laxo, was there. I was just coming off of playing my favorite festival, Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, in San Francisco. So I intentionally went there to meet with everybody. Yeah, heavily listening to country music at the time in general. I think the reason I pulled out Goodyear for the Roses, I was like on my toes, like to be produced by Kate LeBond. I felt like a little more underprepared with new songs than I wanted to go there and bounce off of her. But yeah, Goodyear for the Roses, I knew I just had it in the bag. It was years old by that point.
Right.
It is kind of like a simple nursery rhyme in the way the piano was played, cyclical with the lyrics. But yeah, it never comes out exactly the way you thought. But what I'd like to do is just make it as live as possible. Yeah. And that studio enabled us to do that.
I looked at the credits for the track, and you play bells and guitar, and then you mentioned that earwormy piano melody that you said you kind of brought to the table. You had it in the bag. Is there a story about how you arrived at that?
Yeah, well, the piano line itself, that's what I wrote it on, and that's what I sang and played it live back then. It's just sort of arpeggiating. I mean, I play cyclically anyway, but this is back then. I'm even a little better at piano now. I kind of compose on it pretty much every day, only because there's keyboards all over the house. So you get used to walking by one and playing one for literally a couple seconds to a couple minutes and then move on.
Yeah, can't avoid it.
Just the fact that the piano's right there, it's beautiful. It's acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the keys are right in front of you. The notes are right there. You're staring at the notes in a different way. When I look at the guitar, sure, I know I'm playing the C chord, et cetera, but other times I space out. I don't know exactly where I am, you know?
Yeah.
And also, I'm a little more limited on the piano, so I'm like, oh, yeah, this is A to E to D, you know, that's the classic. And then the more you play country music and things like that, you know, the foundation of music and all the songs you heard in Sunday school, they're all just like either C to F to G or A to E to D.
Right.
Or to G to whatever, you know, dumbing it down a little bit. But, like, it's sort of there in front of you on the piano, that's what I like about it. And the more you play, the more you add your little nuances, but you're ultimately just arpeggiating very simple chords, you know?
Well, Kurt Vile, thanks so much for speaking with me. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, and I can't wait to get down there to Jacksonville.
Kurt Vile and the Violators play Intuition Aleworks on Thursday, May 9th. The show is sold out. For more music news and interviews and information about upcoming shows in Jacksonville, visit jacksmusic.org.
Well, the show is sold out. I am also hoping to be there. That was WJCT's arts and culture editor, Matt Shaw. Stick around. We'll be right back with a bookstore cafe that manages to find a happy medium.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
The University of Florida, a top five public university in the U.S., and its Department of Tourism, Hospitality, and Event Management, or THEM, is offering bachelor's, master's, and Ph.D. degrees. Applicants can search UF-THEM for details. Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
of the next fresh air, Black Twitter and how it became a phenomenon. We talk with director Prentice Penny about his new documentary series on Hulu. Movements like Me Too and Oscar So White grew from this online community. Prentice Penny was the showrunner for Issa Rae's series Insecure. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
For the best music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, tune in to 89.9 HD3, the WJCT app, or jacksmusic.org. We've got your music on Anthology on 89.9 HD3.
Faced with a war in Ukraine and in the Middle East, are our allies spending enough on defense? The UK announced plans to spend billions more, but across Europe, leaders are worried what a possible future Trump presidency means for their security. The head of the UK's armed forces joins us to talk about US leadership and why this year's election in November has left many in NATO feeling nervous. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. A new kind of independent bookstore has found a home in the heart of Riverside. In its brief existence, Happy Medium Books and Cafe has established itself as a hub for artists, musicians, bookworms, and coffee fans. And I'm joined now by the bookstore's owner, Dana Shutters. Hi, Dana.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you get into the book business? It was a little bit unintentional.
Yes. I moved up here from Orlando with my family 2 years ago. I'm a retired teacher and librarian. And I was walking by this upcoming bookstore that was opening, and I contacted the original owner, Annie, and to see if she needed some help. And I started volunteering with her. She opened in July of last year, and then in November she decided she was going to sell and move to Utah, and so I ended up finding my next chapter in my life, and I bought the bookstore.
Next chapter. I see what you did there. Where is the store located for people who haven't been by it?
We are in historic Riverside in the Park and King area in the White Way building.
Okay. So you come to this business as a retired librarian. You obviously have an interest in books, but this bookstore aims to be more than just a bookstore.
Yes, we are new and gently used books. We also of a cafe. We sell local, or we have local coffee and pastries, and we do a lot of events in the cafe.
And you do, it's a performance space, but you also host a lot of book clubs, it looks like. That's kind of an interesting niche.
Yes, we have several book clubs. Our silent book club is very popular. We also have night book clubs, and First Coast Horror Book Club is there as well.
What's a silent book club?
The silent book club, it's really for people who want to they're introverts. They are not all introverts, but they come in, they get a drink, and they sit down, and they read whatever they're reading silently for an hour. And then afterwards, they socialize or go home. But a lot of people don't have that time carved out to read. So it's become really very, very popular.
That's interesting. So they're not all reading the same book?
No.
Wow. Yeah, I could use that, a little time that's just dedicated to that. So how do you describe Happy Medium to other people?
It's really, some people, it's become like a community hub. Some people consider it like a community center. But we have really been embraced by the community. We have art, local artists, all the Jacksonville Art Guild hangs their artwork. We have local musicians that have come and played. We have Jen Chase is coming next Friday for her event with her memoir, which is being re-released. It's called I Can Smell You From Here, her 17 letters to Jacksonville. And she's going to be performing there. So we have a lot of performance space and so forth. So it's just a really a great community place.
And you've also been trying to focus on local authors. I mean, obviously, Jen Chase is a local and known quantity. She's been on this program before, and that performance no doubt will be tremendous. But you've also been trying to cultivate a collection of Jacksonville or at least Northeast Florida based authors.
Yeah, we have local author shelves, and we do Second Sundays with local poets and authors. It's hosted by Brooks Deckard and Tim Gilmore. And they and it's coming up this Sunday as well at 2 p.m. But it's really the people in the community like Tim and Brooks and Jen who've come in and have seen it be such a special place. And they have wanted to help me bring the community in and do these great things. So I could not do that, do these things alone. So it's really helped.
What's the event you were saying that Brooks and Tim host?
It's called Second Sundays with Poets and Authors. And they curate some poets and authors to come in and do readings and every second Sunday.
Excellent. And so what are you reading or recommending these days personally?
Oh, I've just finished reading James by Percival Everett, which is excellent. It's definitely going to win awards.
Remind us, that's the Tom.
It is the
Huck Finn
with Jim's perspective. So that's one that I highly recommend. That's going to be an award winner this year.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about that. So Happy Medium, it's also a cafe, obviously. You can't really separate those two addictions, coffee and books anymore. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, if people want to find more information or check out the calendar and RSVP for some events, how do they do that?
We have an amazing website, and I can say that because I didn't make it. So it's so great. We our event page has a great calendar. So go to our event page, click on those events on the calendar, and it'll take you to exactly where how to get tickets or how to RSVP. But Happy Medium Books Cafe.
All right. Well, Dana Shutters, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire archive at wjct.org or your favorite podcast platform. Join us again tomorrow when we quiz the experts about St. Augustine's lesser-known past as the city's History Festival gets underway. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.